Hi, I'm Bob Crawford, and beginning this winter, I'll be hosting a new original podcast focused on the 2020 presidential election, The Politics of Truth. On The Politics of Truth, we'll get expert analysis from our nation's most reliable journalists, experienced pollsters, pundits, and historians. And because this is the Osiris Network, we're going to speak with musicians from your favorite bands and get their take on the intersection of music, politics, and activism. The Politics of Truth, first episode premieres February 7th. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Visit osirispod.com/politics to learn more. I'm Bob Crawford, and this is The Road to Now. Well, hey, everybody. Ben and I are so excited to share with you today part two from our recent live event at the McGlowan Theater in Charlotte, North Carolina, from a couple weeks ago. This panel is about NASCAR, and we had two amazing guests to talk about the sport. Daniel Pierce, who's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina in Asheville, and racing legend Kyle Petty. Kyle Petty, he comes from racing royalty, son of Richard Petty. So we were thrilled to have both of those guys join us, and it was a great conversation and a lot of fun. And as a bonus, we're going to include one of the songs that David Childers and I got to accompany Kyle on, an original song of his called Lie to Me. I love this song so much. It's a great song. So we thank everyone who came to the show, both that show and the one in Carrboro at the Cat's Cradle. And we've got a few more live shows coming up. Ben and I will be at the Nashville Comedy Festival on Saturday, April 18th at 4 o'clock. It's TPAC's Polk Theater. Tickets are on sale now. Please get them while you can. Langhorne Slim and Tom Shadyac will be our guests for that show. More to be announced soon. And we'll also be at the Minneapolis Comedy Festival on June 16th. That's a Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Tickets are available for both shows. We hope to see you there. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends, rate us on iTunes, and take care of yourselves.
Coming to the stage, we have Bob Crawford, David Childers, and Kyle Petty.
I tell myself I'll get over you. Tell myself I can be strong. I would think about the things we do. I can't go on. But why do I say these things when I know that they're wrong? Nothing's ever gonna change for me now that you're gone. So I lie to me. That's what I do. I tell myself what I say is true. Well, I'm just a fool who needs to believe. So every day I lie to me. Tell myself I'll get over you. Tell myself I can forget the things we used to say and do. And I won't have any regrets. But I know when tomorrow comes, it'll be another day that I'll lie to myself, trying to keep up this charade. Oh, I lie to me. That's what I do. Well, I tell myself that what I say is true. Well, I'm just a fool needs to believe. So every day I lie to me. It's only me that I deceive. So I'll lie to myself as long as I believe. Oh, I lie to me. That's what I do. I tell myself what I say is true. I'm just a fool who needs to believe. So every day I lie to me. Oh, every day I lie to me.
Thank you.
There he is.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Kyle Petty,
everybody.
All right.
Okay.
What are we going to talk about, he says.
He walked off stage, just kept on going yeah. left. He just yeah. kept on going left.
Yep. It's my second lap around the building, and I'm already a lap down.
Kyle, how do you like being a NASCAR analyst after so many years in the car?
That's a good question. You know what? I like being at the racetrack. I like race people. I said it the other day. You drop me in the desert with people who want to talk racing, I'll just stay there. I'm good. So that part's good. The part I miss about not being in a sport is driving, just the driving part. You know, it's like you can go wherever you want to go, but you just can't play. You can't hold the bass and play anymore. You know, you can go listen, but you just can't play. Yeah. So it's the same thing driving a car. You just don't get to drive the thing. So I miss that.
Well, we miss you on the track, man. I grew up watching Kyle race, and it's like such a big deal to have him here. And I want you, I respect you so much that I did not put a picture of you in that mellow yellow jumpsuit you used to wear.
You know what? You should have put it at the same time you had those other photos up there. That would have been classic. Why not put that head on that body? You know what I'm saying?
Because I was trying to get North Carolina to win.
Oh, okay. I got you.
Ben sent me a picture last night of your dad and mom, or was it just your dad?
Mom and dad.
With Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yeah.
In front of the 43.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
My dad's 200th race. The Smithsonian has it. It's a Smithsonian car. It's back at Level Cross now in my dad's museum. But yeah. Went up there to see him. Pretty
That's
cool.
Amazing. I never realized before I started looking, reading up about the history of NASCAR when we did the first episode and then yeah. kind of refreshing on it now. Ronald Reagan was the first ever president to introduce a NASCAR race.
Yeah.
Firecracker 400 in 1984, right?
Yeah.
An election year. That's why it's easy to
That's
remember.
That's exactly right. Air Force One landed. Pretty cool, man. Pretty cool. Yeah. Your driver introduction, you got red dots all over you where guys are like, you know what I'm saying? That Secret Service stuff, man. That's spooky.
Your dad won that race.
Yes.
And you?
I was in it. Yeah. I didn't think this was about my racing career.
It wasn't going to be.
It's false pretense, man. What is up with that?
I was merely reminding people that you're part of a very historic event.
Yeah.
Well,
I've been part of a lot of historic events. I mean, just a part.
You're
just
a great singer, man. Oh, hey, he's a good
thank
singer.
You,
oh my
thank
God.
You,
like, listen
no,
to him warm
you,
up.
Listen, my man David Childers is the guy. I'm telling
he
you, man.
Is.
He is. He is. He
yes.
is. I go with him. He teaches me. He shows me. We were up here during rehearsal, and he's like, "What key is that in?" I said, "I don't know. I start in G." I start at G on this one. I started to say, "I don't know keys. I don't know any of that, but it's fun." It is fun. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And you are a funny man.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Is that recorded?
Yes.
Is that recorded?
Contrary to what your wife said backstage, you are a funny man.
She does not think I'm funny. She has to hear it all the time. She's always like, are you doing a bit on me? And I'm like, no, but yes. I am. It's a lie. No, but going back to that, man, that's the great thing. You're like, I'm with David. You know, it's like my advice in life has always been be with somebody better than you.
Yes.
Right? So be like, they ask me about anything. They're like, how do you get a job like a university professor? I'm like, marry a woman better than you. Like, how do you start a podcast? I'm like, get a guy better than you. Like,
whatever.
That's all I've got, honestly. I tell them, when it comes to getting married, always marry someone better than you, but never let them know that you know that. And she's here.
Too late for me.
I think she knows
too late.
I'm pretty sure she knows it. Well, why don't we bring out Dan Pierce?
Yes.
Let's do it. Ladies and gentlemen, coming to the stage right now, historian at the University of North Carolina, Asheville, and author of the new book on moonshine. Give it up for Dan Pierce.
Thank you.
Well, good to see you again.
Thank you.
I take it you guys have met.
Yes, we've met. We've met. And we've been reminiscing backstage, so we're good.
So, Kyle, tell us the story you grew up learning about the history of NASCAR.
So, which part? See, that's where it gets complicated. So here's what I know about NASCAR is that in a lot of ways, they were already racing on the beach before the war. So, but in a lot of ways, World War II was what, I mean, guys come back from seeing things in Europe and seeing things they never saw on the farm, you know, and it just changed their view of the world. And they were a little rambunctious, a little wild. You did have prohibition. I tell people, and I know he's going to take offense to this, my grandfather was in the beverage transportation business. Now, I don't know what y'all's people are talking about, okay? But you had that culture. You had that culture in the South. We didn't have the Yankees. We didn't have professional football or football and basketball. We didn't have that. But we had a lot of cow fields and cow pastures and a lot of guys with a talent to work on cars and make them run fast, a lot of guys that thought they could go fast, that weren't afraid to put it all on the line, weren't afraid to go against the law, weren't afraid to go the opposite direction. And I think when NASCAR started, that was a big part of our sport, big part. My dad, I've talked to him a couple of times about different things, and you know, he said the first race at Charlotte that at least a third to half the field were ex-moonshine guys or moonshine guys at the time, and especially the guys who owned the cars. Glenn Dunaway won the race, and my dad said the guys who foot the bill for that, yeah, that was Jack Daniels. Okay, that was big time. So I think you go back, it's a part of the sport. And I don't believe, and I know a lot of people that were around then, if you had an opportunity to talk to them, don't believe without Raymond Parks and his moonshine money and his what he did and the loan that he gave to NASCAR and the infusion of money would have kept NASCAR afloat during those early years. So that's where our sport came from. You know, there's been a lot of denial through the years. We can talk about that all you want to. Been a lot of denials, but you know, my dad always said, we're from Level Cross, North Carolina. That's where you're from. That's where you go back to. Don't get above your raisins. That's where you're from. And that's what our sport was founded on. We tried to push it to the side some, but it's always been a part of it. It began to disappear as we exit the 50s and the latter part of the 50s and into the 60s. And there's always a little bit of that out there. Listen, I raced in the 80s, and I knew guys that still had steals and still brought liquor to the racetrack. So I can't say that it was gone in the 80s completely.
Was it you?
It was not me.
Right answer.
Not me. I was a customer. But that's a whole other story. No, but I'm just saying it is a part of our sport. It is a part, and it's tried to be shoveled under.
Yeah, and this gets into Dan, your book. You just wrote a book on NASCAR called Real NASCAR. That book, when we first got Kyle on a couple of years ago, I was like, I grew up watching NASCAR. My grandma was a Dale Earnhardt fan, right? And I just watched it. I still to this day, when I'm in class, Kyle, when I'm in class and I got a headache, before class, I will get out a goodie powder and I will look. I will look at the audience. My students, and I will hold it up and I will say goodie powders or feist, and then I will take the goodie powder in homage to your father, who was the number one spokesman for goodie powders. Which, if you don't know what it is, it's like if aspirin couldn't get into your blood fast enough and yes. you crushed it up like a heroin addict. Yeah. That's what it is.
That's exactly right.
And it is face, that's for sure.
And a Mountain Dew.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and a Mountain Dew. Wash one.
Yeah, now my dad took so many of them, he took them dry. No water. No water. He just, done.
It is the greatest generation, I think.
Yes, that's a fact. That's a fact.
That's amazing. So Dan, you wrote this book on NASCAR. And I loved it. I mean, I picked that book up and was like, you know, when you learn to read books in grad school as an academic, you learn to like extract, right? Called gutting a book. You go through and you get the most important. And I just sat down. I was at my mom's house visiting. And I just read and read and read all these great interviews. And so now we're getting to the question of liquor and the denial. And when you went to start your research, you tried to get into the archives for NASCAR, right?
Yes.
And how'd that go?
It didn't. Well, NASCAR is very protective of its image, and of course, that's if you go to the NASCAR Hall of Fame here in Charlotte, there is a still, which actually they—I'm not sure who provided it—but but when the still came in, all the parts and everything, they didn't know how to put it together, so they called Junior Johnson, and Junior came down with his pipe wrench and put the thing together. So there is that still, but the way NASCAR spends it is yes, there were a few moonshiners in the early days. See Junior Johnson, because it's undeniable because he went to federal prison for his activities, and he freely admitted that. And Tom Wolfe wrote this famous article in Esquire magazine about him, and so that was there. But you know, as an academic looking into this. Well, historians have this mantra, which I pound into my students, is we trust no one. And so we, you know, we are the world's greatest skeptics, or should be at least. And so when I went into it, looking at the history of NASCAR, I really thought that a lot of these stories about moonshine and liquor running and stuff like that were exaggerated. But as I put it in the book, the deeper I looked, the more liquor I found. And it really just permeated the sport at every level. And Kyle hit on that with not only drivers, but car owners, mechanics. And one of the most surprising things that some of the people you should mention in terms of the roots of NASCAR that were so key were people like Enoch Staley and Clay Earls and the Charles brothers, who started the old Charlotte Speedway, where the first strictly stock NASCAR race was held over on Little Rock Road, and the Burgess brothers in Hickory, and these were all big-time bootleggers. And I won't go into the details of why they might possibly want to own a racetrack, but you don't have to have a vivid imagination to figure that out.
So you weren't a fan of NASCAR when you first started researching it?
Now, I grew up in a working-class area of Asheville, which is very hip now, West Asheville. Mm-hmm. But when I was growing up, it was called Worst Asheville. Yes. And part of the worst of it and the rednecky part of it was that there was a speedway, what they call the New Asheville Speedway or New Asheville Speedway down on the river there. And you could hear it, but my dad was a Southern Baptist preacher. And so we could hear them racing down on the river, but that wasn't something we went to. And so we kind of had aspirations and everything. And as I went through school and stuff, it was something I kind of made fun of. But I had a roommate in college named Don Good. And Don grew up in Hickory. His dad was a truck driver. And they spent their weekends in the infield of a racetrack. Mostly dad had a camper on the back of the pickup truck. And he always tried to get me to go, and it wasn't until 1994 that I finally broke down. I was about to finish up my PhD in Southern history, and I said, if I'm going to be a Southern historian, you have to go to a stock car race. So it just so happened, and particularly in the 90s, Kyle can tell you the significance of this, it just happened my first race was the night race at Bristol. It just really doesn't get any better than that. And so I went to that race, and the first thing, you know, I was just astounded, you know, because back then it was huge. It had about 80,000 seats. I think now it has 160-something or something like that. But I'm just, you know, the experience was overwhelming, the smells of the gas and the rubber. I mean, just the sensory experience of a race, particularly at Bristol, August night, you know, it's just overwhelming. And so then the race starts, and my friend had not said anything about ear protection. And I had no clue. I mean, I thought my head was going to explode. I mean, it was just, I mean, you can't imagine the sound. You have to experience it.
Kyle, how's your hearing?
What? Perfect. Ask my wife.
Mine's not as good as yours is.
But the thing that really hooked me, though, on the whole thing were the fans. It was just unbelievable. And that era was really a time where the fans were intense. Jeff Gordon was just coming on the scene, and the crowd was about split between probably a quarter of the crowd were Jeff Gordon fans and another quarter were Dale Earnhardt fans, and it was a morality play, good and evil. But then everybody had fans. I'll never forget, I saw a guy that had a hard hat on and a can of Spam glued to the top of it. And he was a Lake Speed fan, you know, so maybe not only, but they all had fans. And I just love that. And the thing that really got me, there was a guy sitting in front of me, and we were probably 150 rows up, way up above the track. At Bristol, the cars come by about every 16, 17 seconds. He would stand up every time Dale Earnhardt's car came by. And give him the middle finger. It wasn't the three. He was an Earnhardt hater. And he'd give him the middle finger every time. 500 laps.
Lots. Yeah.
And that hooked me. I said, I got to find out more about this.
So you talk about that 90s era of racing. Where are we now?
I don't know. Yeah, and honestly.
I mean, the sport's really gone through a lot of changes the past 10 years.
Yes. I think it's still trying to find how it fits in this day and time. There have been so many antiquated things about the sport and in general. And what I mean by that is, until 4 or 5 years ago, we still ran carburetors. You couldn't buy a car at a dealership with a carburetor on it. Rear-wheel drive. I mean, everything's right. So many things, we ventured off in a different direction. And NASCAR is trying to get their arms wrapped back around it. And we can go back to the history. Bill France Sr. ran the sport as a dictator, and so did his son, Jr. The sport's not a dictatorship anymore. Is that good? I don't know. It flourished under a dictator, but it's not flourishing as much now. TV ratings have been down, but... You know, if you look around here, there's people with their phones out right now. So people don't, it's not about the TV so much. You know, I mean, it's a phone, it's a tablet, it's a computer. There's so many different ways to take in, not only the sport, your music. I mean, it's that industry's changed. You talk about an industry has changed. So it's on a little bit of an upswing, I believe. Over the last couple of years, you can't begin to rebuild until you hit rock bottom. And I think we hit rock bottom a couple of years ago. I do. And I think the new drivers, the influx of the Chase Elliotts, the influx of the Ryan Blaneys, as we look at some of the young drivers, Kyle Larson, some of those guys, they've got to give you a reason to pull for them. Richard Petty gave you a reason to pull for him. David Pearson gave you. Dale Earnhardt Sr., Rusty Wallace, Mark Martin, those guys in the 80s and 90s gave you a reason. They got up and got in somebody's face or did something, and you wanted to pull for them. You
know, or a reason to hate them.
Yeah, or hate them. Either way, you've got to the passion needle has to move, and you know these guys, the passion needle doesn't move as much anymore. And the other thing is, I think, and if we go back to and we incorporate, you know, moonshine and liquor into this, that guy who went to that first race at Charlotte and saw a moonshiner driving a car, and he was doing it on the side, he's thinking, I can do that.
Right.
I could be a race car driver. We get to the 60s, and you still had that feeling with a lot of fans. I can do that. There before the grace of God, I'm Richard Petty. I'm Buddy Baker. I'm that guy out there. Somewhere we've lost that, where the guy in the fan and the stands, they can't relate. They don't relate as much. But I think the sports right now is really headed in a good direction. I think NASCAR... And Mike Helton and those guys have their arms wrapped around it. I think the TV package and what they're trying to do to it is headed in the right direction. But understand this, for everybody out there, sports are not really sports anymore. They're business. It's business. And when business and sports meet, it changes both. It changes both. And same with music. If the business gets in between the heart and soul of what the song is, it's a different song. And it's the same way with our racing. If as business has come into the sport, as it's grown, as it's gotten bigger, it's changed. And it's changed how the teams perceive it, how the fans perceive it, and it changes the product that's on the racetrack. If we can go back to a good product on the racetrack, a product like we had in the 60s and 70s, a product like we had in the 80s and 90s, fans will come.
It also changes the racetracks themselves.
Yes, it does. Yeah, for sure. And we've seen that. You know, we see that with, not going to be popular, but we see that with the gimmick type things of a Roval, of the gimmick type things of running different races to get fans excited again. You know, I don't have to go to a Major League Baseball game and then play with a fluorescent baseball for me to get excited about baseball. I know it's baseball. You know what I'm saying?
So do you think that those things have been successful?
They have been successful. Okay. They have been successful. The Roval has been extremely successful. And as a purist and a guy who grew up in it, I'm not saying I was the biggest fan of it, but when I look in the grandstands and I see the excitement in the fans, that's what it's about. It's about getting those young fans and bringing people back in. What's that gateway? What's that portal to bring that fan back that kind of went away? Or bring that fan's son back, or that grandson of that fan, how do we get them back through? Is it with big screen TVs? Is it with free Wi-Fi at the racetrack? Is it with an opportunity to go down in the pits? I mean, there's a multitude of ways, and I think the racetracks are exploring, and I think NASCAR is. So I think there's a lot of positives. There's a lot more positives headed into 2020 than I think there were in 2019, and a lot more than there were 4 or 5 years ago.
I think your discussion about, like, what you said about how people feel alienated from it, I will tell you that my wife, she purchased a 2015 Ford Fusion, and, yeah, there's no way I think I can get it on a track and race it in a NASCAR race. And that's, like, it's like kind of a joke, but you told a story on our podcast last time about how when your father was racing your grandfather, when you were a little kid, yeah, they'd bring three cars up
they'd
to
bring
you
cars.
Guys.
Yeah.
Did you tell that story?
Yeah, they would. When I grew up with, and a car hauler from Detroit would show up and unload three cars, 367 Plymouth Furies, okay? And they would drop them off. And my grandmother would drive one, and my mom would drive one, and they would turn one into a race car. And if my dad crashed that one, either my grandmother was going to be without a car or my mom was going to be out of a car because they were going to turn that one into a race car. And that's what they did. And they were stock cars. They were true cars. And a car that you could go to the dealership in 67 and buy. And that's how that was that connection. You saw that car. You know, we've with the aero package and so many things that we have now and technology and technology did not ruin the sport, okay? So many people say, oh, technology ruined the sport. Okay, go back to your black and white TV. I don't care. You know what I mean? Doesn't bother me. Technology enhances everything. You just have to understand how to control it and how to implement it and how to use it in the right ways. And I think sometimes it's gotten ahead of our sport, and we're now catching back up.
I agree.
Dan, are there any, in all the oral histories you've conducted of the sport, are there any stories you think that Kyle's never heard that you've heard?
Well, I told him one earlier today because the second interview I did was with his dad, and it was an amazing experience to go down to Level Cross and walk in there and then to be escorted into his office. What was his secretary's name?
Was Martha Jane there?
Martha Jane.
Martha Jane was there
for
40 years.
Yeah. And anyway, Martha Jane escorts me in, and there he sits. And I don't think there were any windows in that office.
There's not. Where
he's
there's
wearing
not.
His hat. He's wearing his sunglasses. He's got a can of Pepsi there, but he's spitting dip into it. But that was an amazing experience.
Was there any goodie powders in the
desk?
Oh,
they're there.
I didn't see any, but I'm sure they were there. And but I talked to him for an hour and a half, and I ended the interview because I thought this man is important and busy, and I can't monopolize his time. But there were so many. I mean, Kyle hit it on the head there early on when he was talking about the people that you come in contact with, and all the people I interviewed were people who raced primarily in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and some into the 80s. And there was only, and they were just so generous. They were so kind, and they were so, for the most part, forthcoming about all kinds of stuff, particularly related to moonshine. But except for one, I won't mention who that one person was that would not do an interview with me. But I started out, the very first interview I did was with Ned Jarrett, and who's called Gentleman Ned, and just a wonderful person, although he was one that was not very forthcoming about the moonshine part. You know, it was kind of like, well, you know, I've heard there might have been a person or two like that, but I really don't recall anyone. But anyway, I'm driving to this. He's in, lives in Newton near Hickory. I'm driving to the interview, and, you know, being the son of a Baptist preacher, I believe in divine signs at time. And I had a sign that I was doing the right thing that day. So I'm driving down this road, going to Ned Jarrett's house, and I look in my rearview mirror. This is probably about 1999 that I'm doing this, and there is a black Chevrolet Monte Carlo on my bumper. I look, the guy driving it had this black mustache, sunglasses on, chrome sunglasses, and I'm going, oh my gosh, Dale Earnhardt is on my tail. And I didn't know what to do. So I thought, what did I do? Did I jam my brakes on and, you know, let him hit me so I could say I got rear-ended by Dale Earnhardt? So I was supposed to turn off to go to Ned Jarrett's house, but I just kept driving. And so I'm going down the road, and the road dead ends into another road. And so I turn right. He turns left, and so I think, I can't be late for this interview, so I have to go back. So anyway, after I did the interview with Ned Jarrett, I said, I had the strangest experience coming over here, and he said, you may think I'm crazy. I said, but I swear Dale Earnhardt was on my rear bumper. And he said, I don't think so. But then he goes, but you know, that's the way he would go if he's going to his car dealership. So I believe to this day that I had a special visitation from Dale Earnhardt, which some people will equate with a visitation from God for sure. But
You know, I will say, my dad, the older guys would tell this story. You know why they call him Gentleman Ned? Because he'd wreck you on the backstretch where the fans couldn't see it. Yeah.
That was the other thing I found.
That's an old school story. Okay, sorry.
That was the other thing that was amazing, interviewing these guys, because they're in their 60s, 70s, and they were so competitive.
Oh, yeah, still.
And I'll never forget when David Pearson thought that I'd implied that he caused that wreck at Daytona in 76. And, man, I go, good grief. I said, but that explains a lot. I mean, these are not, you know, as much as we might want to believe that we can do that and we can be that, no, we can't.
Yeah.
They're different people. Those guys of that generation.
Yeah, they are. And I will tell this real quick. I did an interview with Pearson back in, had to be 08, 09, 10, right along that. And I asked him a question, and he was, golly, that would have been, he would have been 70, early to mid-70s. And I said, look, you're David Pearson. There's Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, Carl Edwards at the time, Kevin Harvick. You're 30 years old. Could you run with him? Hadn't got that out. And he said, that's not the question. The question is, could they run with me? He said, I can beat them right now for 5 laps. I can't go 500, but I can go 5. And I thought to myself, that just reaffirmed to me, as I was a kid growing up with those guys, with being in the garage area in the late 60s and the 70s with Pearson and Baker and Bobby and Donnie and Kale and Leroy and all those guys, is you'd look at them and you think, golly, how they run 500 miles? But the distance from this ear to this ear and what was in here was tough. They were mentally tough. They would sit in a car at 130 degrees with blisters on their hands, knowing they had to make money. They had to beat the other guy, and they weren't going to be the first one to blink. They just weren't going to be the first one to blink. And they would run themselves in the ground on a Sunday afternoon to stand in victory lane for that trophy. That's what it was about to almost every one of those guys during that generation. It's a crazy group of guys to talk to, but they are, you call them the greatest. They are the greatest group of race car drivers to ever come through this sport. I'll say that until the day I die.
Kyle, before we end the interview, we have to ask you about Victory Junction.
Victory Junction, for you that do know or you that don't know, is a camp. My grandfather, as we start into this, my grandfather started racing in the late 40s. My dad came along in the 50s, late 50s. I came along in the late 70s. And then I had a son that came along in the late 90s. And he was killed in a racing accident in New Hampshire. And we started a camp in North Carolina, just outside of Greensboro, called Victory Junction. It's a camp for children with chronic and life-threatening illnesses. I had run a race and done some sports car racing. The 24 Hours of Daytona is going on this weekend. With Paul Newman, who started the hole-in-the-wall gang camps. And when Adam's accident happened, Paul and I, we talked about some stuff, and we ended up building the camp. We've seen at camp and at different medical facilities where we have basically camp in a box, we go to different hospitals, a little over 50,000 kids in the 15 years that we've been open, free of charge to all parents and all kids that come. And that's what's cool about being in this NASCAR community. And we talk about, we can sit here and talk racing and talk what racing is, but it is the most caring, giving group of people in that garage area, in that industry. But that translates to you guys, to the fans, who are Kevin Harvick fans, who are Joey Logano fans, who are Kyle Busch fans, whoever you may be.
He has one?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. He's married. That was wrong. Good. But it is the most amazing group and of people, and it gives us an opportunity to give back to kids. And I can't begin to tell you how much that has meant to myself. We do a motorcycle ride every year across country, the Cal Petty Charity Ride Across America. My wife, Morgan, is in the audience there. She runs it. Jenny tallies with her. She does the media for it. All that money goes to send kids to camp. All the money that we raised last year, I think we raised right at $2 million. All that money goes to send kids to camp. And that's important. I told you, we were talking earlier. We have a tendency in this life and in this world to do something and stand back and pat ourselves on the back and say, look at what I just did. Look at what I just did. And when camp was built, we had a tendency to stand back and look and say, man, look at this place. Looks like Disney World here in North Carolina. It's pretty cool. And then the kids start coming in, and you start talking to the kids, and you hang out with the kids, and you think, oh my God, look what they just did for me. Look what these kids did for me. Their attitude on life, how they approach every day, how they smile. It is a true blessing to be around these kids every single day that they're at camp, that their parents give them to us to look after for a week, and then we give them back and hope they come back next year. It is a special, special place. If you ever have an opportunity and you're up around the big city of Randleman in North Carolina, stop by Victory Junction. Take a tour. See what it's all about. Go online to victoryjunction.org. See what it's like. If you know of a child who can benefit from a camp like this, please contact us. Because we are constantly, constantly looking for campers. We were full last year for the first time in a while, constantly looking for volunteers. And I tell people, man, we take any donation. You give us a pig, we'll make barbecue. Promise you. Promise you. Any donation, that's the way it goes.
Kyle Petty, Dan Pierce, thanks, guys.
We got one last...
Before you leave, though,
Dane Honeycutt, are you side stage? If so, I need the clicker. We have a game to play with Kyle and Dan. I'm just going to grab the clicker real quick. So, you both know a lot about NASCAR, and if there's one thing anybody knows about NASCAR, it's that there are a lot of sponsors. Sometimes they're kind of weird, right? But some sponsors in other sports are way weirder. So we're going to play a game with you guys right now. It's called Bad Sponsors.
There is no such thing as a bad sponsor.
Well, we'll find out about that, Kyle.
Cash is king, baby. Cash is king.
Are we talking about Dick Trickle having Depends as a sponsor?
Oh.
Good gracious.
Oh, my God. Is that in the liner notes on what is that?
So here's the way it works, all right? You guys will be playing for one of our patrons on Patreon. We randomly drew one, and we got Joseph Mann. So if you guys can get two out of three of these questions right, then Joseph Mann will get a free Road to Now t-shirt and a brand new one, a light blue one,
God,
which we
pressure.
Just released tonight. So are you ready to play?
Tar Heel blue, right?
That's pressure.
All right.
Can I just buy him a t-shirt?
Absolutely. So here we go. All right. Are you ready? Okay. In 1981, the Italian soccer team AC Milan wore jerseys advertising. What did they advertise? Was it Poo Jeans, Huff Markers, or Pizza Hut?
1981. I was really into soccer in 81, too.
How about the jeans? But
I would say that. That's a good one.
Which one?
Poo Jeans.
Poo Jeans. What do you guys think?
Come on, Pizza Hut's too simple, people.
They're in Italy.
Yeah.
Bad sponsor.
They don't call it Pizza Hut in Italy.
It's Poojing.
Poojing!
Hey! One down.
And if you like that picture, how about that one?
Oh, my God.
And if you notice right there at the bottom, this is what I love. It just says, shoot. Good thing I'm wearing my Poojing.
Man.
All right, so you've got one
that
right.
That needs to come back.
Oh, I think it might. New Road to Now shirts are just 1991 AC Milan jerseys. All right. In 1987, the German ice hockey team, ECD Iserhorn, were desperate enough to take a sponsorship deal offered by, was it A, their rivals, Dusseldorf EG? Was it B, Old Milwaukee Beer? Or was it C, Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi?
I think it's got to be Gaddafi.
What did he offer you one too?
Yeah. Well, he was sponsoring a lot of things. Yes. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who deny any connection to him who were going to Libya at the
I heard
time.
He was a state sponsor or something.
No, he offered us Old Muammar beer. Yeah. That's what it was.
What do you guys think? Gaddafi?
Muammar. Yeah.
Yep. That's right.
No way.
It was Gaddafi.
That's a fact.
Yes. That is a fact. This is a picture of the jersey right here. So apparently...
I don't know. It's written in German. I can't read it.
Yeah,
Gaddafi.
I don't think it's worth it if you could. So here's the thing. Gaddafi wrote a book in the early 1980s that was like his plan for world revolution, and apparently nobody wanted to buy it. So he was like, what if I could sponsor a German ice hockey team?
There you go.
And as you guys know, we all work for Gaddafi now. Just kidding. Yes. I don't think it worked.
World domination starts on a hockey rink. Remember that, people.
This is an amazing story. Also, what I love is like, look at this guy. He's like, I know. That's not even a goalie. They all just dressed like that so no one could tell who they were.
That's bulletproof.
Oh, God. Let's hope. Anyway, so, all right, that's two. So let's see if you can go perfect.
So we win already.
Not yet. All right.
I thought it was two for three.
Yeah, but there's got to be three if it can be two for three. Otherwise, it's two for two, and that doesn't win anything. All right.
Got it. Good point.
Thank you. Doing nothing to improve their sports reputation amongst American dads. In 2007 and 2008, the German soccer team FC Nuremberg wore jerseys with the company name, was it A, Not a Sport, B, Mr. Lady, or C, I Am Weak? Which one was actually on their jersey?
I Am Weak. That's
you think so? I don't know.
It's a little hard.
What? Wait a minute. What?
What was actually on their jersey that year? Was it Not a Sport, Mr. Lady, or I Am Weak?
Look, I'm not an academic, so I won't be able to answer this one.
And you know what's funny is Dan's not even helping him. He's got a PhD in history.
I know, obviously.
He knows the answer to the question.
Hey, I played the
history
card on the last one.
Which one do you think?
I think that I am weak.
You think that you were weak? Okay, he said it. Yeah. Here's what he said.
I think it's great.
So. Oh, it worked. Actually, it's Mr. Lady.
Oh.
And that guy looks like he just found out that was their sponsor while he was wearing the jersey.
Oh, my God, Mr. Lady.
That's it. How many times have I said, oh, God, Mr. Lady? Anyway, so that's it. But
you guys got
two out of three.
That's
Joseph Mann's getting a Road to Now shirt.
Thank goodness.
And ladies and gentlemen, that is our show. Give it up for our guests, Kyle Petty and Dan Pierce, Tom Hanch and Pam Kelly.
David Childers.
That's right. We thank you guys for being here, for coming out. I know it's raining. Love you guys. Have a great night.
Take care. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode was edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer, and today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. If you have not gone and rated us on iTunes, please do so. We need you to do that so we can spread the word about this podcast. Everyone who has, we say thank you. Speaking of thanks, we'd like to say a special thanks to everyone on Patreon who helps make this podcast possible, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCane, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, Joseph Mann, Matt Williams, and Mariah Wolford. If you'd like to join our community of patrons and get lots of extra content, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow and pick a tier. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to episodes 1 through 75, some extras, bonus content, and it only gets better from there. For Bob Crawford, this has been Sawyer. Thanks for listening, and take care.